Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Hi, everybody. Welcome this evening. We have an intimate crowd and a very special event. Patricia Powell is here to read from her work. My name is Kenneth Clark. I'm the executive director of the Poetry Center of Chicago, and I am in my eighth month of being such, started last June. We're now in our 26th year at the Poetry Center, and we're proud to continue our tradition of showcasing America's and the world's finest writers here in Chicago. We're also committed to a program called Hands on Stanzas. It's a Poets in Schools program where we pay Chicago poets to teach children how to read and write poetry, what we call creative writing literacy. I want to take a couple moments just to say thank you to our many supporters who make these readings possible. On the back of tonight's program, if you didn't pick it up, you can pick it up in a little bit. It looks like this. All of our members, our board of directors, who have gone over and above the basic $60 membership and given a larger contribution to help the Poetry Center with its mission. And I also want to thank the many volunteers working for the Poetry Center. My wife, Laura Biddle Clark, I have hornswoggled into sitting at the table, and Dave Gichick is the other guy who is one of our poets in the school. So if you want information about that program, talk to him. I also want to thank, let's see, Marie Hayes, Jacob Brody, Gordon Stearns, Mark Perlberg, they're all board members, and Debbie Rosen, anybody else that I'm seeing here? Okay. Who are on the Board of Trustees of the Poetry Center and have been working very hard for the Poetry Center. We are also in debt and thankful for the sponsorship the School of the Art Institute provides. We get our office space and we get this beautiful ballroom to hold these events in. Through our relationship with the School of the Art Institute, major programming comes from the Lannan Foundation. We were just awarded a $60,000 grant for our reading program and also for other kinds of operations that we're doing. The Fred and Susan Novy Family Foundation is supporting the Poets in Schools program called Hands on Stanzas. Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs, as well as the Illinois Arts Council, a state agency, support our programs. If you're not a member of the Poetry Center, I encourage you to join. It's easy. It gets you access to all the readings in the course of a year. And if you join at the $60 level, you get to pick a Lannan literary video from this catalog. There's examples back on the back table. The other thing, and then the last thing that I can say, Prairie Restaurant has offered us wonderful in-loop rates for housing our artists. Very, very cheap, astronomically cheap for being in the loop. And also anybody who attends a Poetry Center event and fills out a survey can get a 25% off coupon for a meal anytime at Prairie, and it's delicious food. It is now my pleasure to introduce Beth Nugent. She is the chair of the writing program at the School of the Art Institute, and she's a good friend of the Poetry Center. Beth.
It's a particular pleasure for me to introduce Patricia Powell tonight. But I have to do this. A few years ago, I was teaching at another institution, not this one, and we, in the creative writing program, were given a grant to set up a reading series. What we decided to do was set up a symposium on politics and the writer. And one of the writers we invited was Patricia Powell. I left then to come here, and my colleagues took great pleasure. I mean, the symposium went on despite my absence, and my colleagues took great pleasure in emailing me about how wonderful Patricia Powell was. What a wonderful writer, what a wonderful person, what a wonderful speaker, thinker, everything. And how sad it was that my decision to leave meant that I missed her. So it's been a project for me to bring her here, and I'm looking forward to emailing my former colleagues about her reading. Patricia Powell is, to my mind, a political writer, and in the most profound sense. She's the author of three novels, Me Dying Trial, A Small Gathering of Bones, and most recently, The Pagoda. Currently, she's at work on a fourth. And while the subjects of those novels seem to be on the surface quite disparate, the first concerns a young woman in rural Jamaica. The second focuses on gay male culture in Jamaica at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. And the last one, the pagoda, the main character is Mr. Low, a Chinese immigrant to Jamaica in the late 19th century. Despite this, all three novels take place in the social and cultural and psychic spaces where identity is simultaneously constructed and erased. Powell's characters struggle to negotiate complexities of race, culture, gender, class, sexuality, history, and language. And each of these novels is engaged both intensely and subtly with critical issues of self and other. In her essay, Sorties, Elaine Sissou describes the woman writer as follows. She comes out of herself to go to the other, a traveler in unexplored places. She does not refuse. She approaches, not to do away with the space between, but to see it, to experience what she is not, what she is, what she can be. Asked in a recent interview if she had any advice for aspiring novelists, Powell's response was, take risks. Try out characters different from yourself. And if you fail at first, keep challenging yourself and the way you tend to see the world. It's my pleasure to introduce Patricia Powell.
Thank you, Beth, and good evening, and thank you very much for inviting me to come to Chicago and to read at the Poetry Center. I've never been to Chicago before, so this is a real treat. And it's not as cold as I thought. A little bit about the pagoda. The pagoda is set in the 19th century in rural Jamaica. It's a novel about Chinese immigration to Jamaica. And specifically, it follows the experiences of Lo, a Chinese woman passing as a male shopkeeper. And I'll read two sections from the pagoda. I had always, growing up in Jamaica, I had always been interested in the Chinese who live there and have been there since the 19th century. And As a kid, I went to school with many Chinese children and was always curious about them because so little about the Chinese was written about in our history books, and so there was almost no knowledge. So that curiosity stayed with me for many years. The novel is about Lo, and Lo is referred to as he throughout the novel, though very early on, as early as page 60 or so, the reader comes to realize that Lo is not a he, but a she. So the he's I'll be referring to will be Lo, but you should remember that Lo is really a lady. I'll read two sections. And this one is fairly self-explanatory. I don't think it needs an introduction. The next morning, Lo did not go to the woods, but stooped down in the doorway of the smoky kitchen with Dulce. Okay, maybe it does need an introduction. Dulce is the housekeeper. Lo lives with Miss Sylvie. There's an arranged marriage, and Lo lives with Miss Sylvie and Miss Sylvie's housekeeper, Dulce, and Dulce's son, Amar. And this is a little piece about Dulce. When the novel opens, Lo has had a shop for 30 years, and when the novel opens, the shop has been burnt to the ground. And her life begins to unravel after that. Everything she has owned has gone to pieces, and she goes to pieces in a way, and the novel is about her recovery. And instead of rebuilding the shop, she decides to build this pagoda, a sort of cultural center so that the Chinese people and the children of the immigrants can come and have a place to be. So this is a little piece about Dulce, the housekeeper. When the shop burns down and Lo begins to fall apart, part of her recovery involves going into the community and relating with people in a very different way and establishing close ties with the Chinese community. She had been a very isolated person. The next morning, Lo did not go to the woods, but stooped down in the doorway of the smoky kitchen with Dulce and looked out at the slant of the squalling rain and listened to the pattering on the roof, and Dulce did not disturb him. She nosed the bristles of her broom around the edges of his shoes, and the bottom of her floral skirts lashed his cheeks, and he inhaled her perfume and the odor of her sweat, and he studied her sighs, which sounded to him like screams, and tried to decode the moods betrayed by her murmuring, the messages hidden in her back, in the hump of shoulders, in the sturdy neck. He glanced at her unreadable brown eye when she handed him his meals and worried that he had stumbled into more of the murky secrets of the family. He felt trapped in the middle of things, and Omar's blackmail, he was certain, was just the beginning. He wondered if Dulce was entrenched in this plan with Omar, if she too had her eyes on Miss Sylvie's land, if she too had her axe to grind. He did not know these people with whom he had lived all these years. He did not know them. They were an armored gang. He wondered if what the villagers had said about Dulce was true. For after all these years, the people in the shop had never stopped speculating about her past. And as she was never one to come down to the shop and sit out on the piazza and labrish with other women who had a scrap of time to spare, as she was never one to reveal much of herself just so, they didn't know how to read her. But they speculated nonetheless. She was from Trinidad, that they knew, for it was there in the song of her speech. And like them, she had worked out herself on the estates as a girl, picking crocus bags of lime and peanut and orange, carrying cane. They knew. They heard the rattle of dust in her voice. They saw the line-striped face that symbolized suffering. They saw the muscle-bound arms that had known the weight of cane loads. But more important, they wondered, if she was that same Dulcimina that years ago had a bounty out on her head, starting at 75 pounds and rising. News had it that on one of the estates she had organized workers to protest the pittance that was their wages and for which they worked 18 and 20 hours a day. News had it that she had begged the poor people to ban their bellies, and so for weeks and weeks workers did not show up and the cane fields lay rutted with the abandoned and rotting bundles of cane. News had it that she and her people had set fire to buildings and to fields, that they had sabotaged the factory equipment and had marched in front of estates with their signs and burning eyes, with their rage pouring in song. News had it that the protesters had been shot down by the hundreds and by the thousands by police in cold blood, and that several more hundred had been beaten and left to rot out their time in jail. News had it that Dulce and others had escaped and that the countryside had been scoured for their whereabouts, that bounties were posted, and at a price so high, her own people had captured her and turned her in. News had it that she had been beaten almost to death and left in the prison to die, that she had been paraded naked through the streets, her skin gutted by whiplash. But somehow money had been put up for her trial. Humanitarian efforts and rich English people had rallied round her cause, it seemed. They put up the money, news had it, and set defense lawyers on the case to save her. Was it the same Dulce, they wondered? For she had the left eye that barely opened, the broken nose that lay like a fist on her face, the split top lip that had grown slightly curled, the missing fingers on her left hand that had dropped off from gangrene. Was it the same Dulce, Dulcimina Maitland? Lo had never engaged her in a serious and deep conversation, and so he did not know. He thought once to ask her, but there was nothing at all about her demeanor that invited his questions. Indeed, she had always seemed remote, but that wasn't a bad streak in a person, he decided. She seemed completely devoted to Miss Sylvie and to Omar, and when her duties were done, she sat by herself, smoking her clay pipe and looking out at the world from her roost in the kitchen with just the one shimmering eye. It was as if she had been terribly burned, as if the light or the fire that once charged her had run its course and now, years later, had left her extinguished. But wasn't that the nature of fire, he decided, once its fuel was done, to leave just the exhausted frame? She barely smiled. He had never heard her laugh. But then again, given the kind of world it was, what was there to laugh at? He knew she combed the same newspaper daily, poring over the same article, reading and rereading and grunting the same profound grunt, though, as far as he knew, she couldn't as much as spell her name. Was it the announcement with word of the bounty, he wondered? He did not know these people and their designs. He did not know. He did not know. Lo kept his eyes on the lookout for Miss Sylvie, but of her there was no sign. She left early in the wagon each morning and did not return till nightfall. He had no idea where they went, and he was too humiliated to ask. But he was worried, for clearly it was blackmail. Clearly Omar would talk, would tell people. He did not know if Omar was bluffing or if he in fact knew, and knew what, and what exactly would he tell people. Omar has threatened to tell the villagers that Lo is female and not male, as they had thought all along. But he was worried, for clearly it was blackmail. Clearly Omar would talk, would tell people. He did not know if Omar was bluffing, or if he in fact knew, and knew what, and what exactly would he tell people. And the villagers, after he told them, would they just descend on the house with their tins of kerosene and catch them on fire? Would they parade both him and Miss Sylvie through the road, stoning them with rocks and lashing them with insults? Would they tie them to posts and leave them there in the scorching sun? He did not know. He did not know. The land was his daughter's. The land was to build his pagoda. The land was there so they could live comfortably. He had lived in that house all those years, but he still did not know why Sylvie was there. He did not know Omar or Dulce, and in the short time he tried to get close to Omar, he had already been burned. He didn't know anything about the land. He didn't understand Omar's intent. He didn't know what bones they all had to pick with Miss Sylvie. He did not know. He did not know. In this next scene, Lo goes back to the shop of his competitor, Miss Cora. This is the first time he's gone back to see the villagers after they have devastated his shop. And he doesn't know if Omar has gotten there ahead of him. One night, when there was no sleep to be had, no dreams to disguise his despair, no dreams to ease the whirlpool of thoughts, to relieve his fear of the horror that was to unfold when Omar decided to reveal his plan, Lo leapt out of bed and hauled on his clothes and shoes parked at the door, and was swinging down the steep stone steps of the veranda and into the blinding dark, picking out his way past the burnt-out ruins of his shop, where he had not been since the devastation. The rain squalled into his hat, and the light breeze rustled the fuzz on his neck, and he stepped quickly, wanting only to reach in time before the men returned to their homes and the comfort of their wives and lovers, before there was no one with whom he could share his solitude. Part of the way he ran, hoping not to fall, and the smell of fields and the loamy earth suffused with the burning remains of his shop rushed out at him, and the cave of his stomach trembled again, just remembering. The night was black, and the pupils of his eyes picked out needles of light spiraling from Miss Cora's shop, and he could hear bursts of laughter. He walked slowly again to ease the boom-boom of his chest, to calm the flutter of his eyelids, and he hoped with all his might that Omar had not gotten there ahead of him. It was the shop belonging to his main competitor, Miss Cora, who was a shrewd businesswoman and not so prone to trusting goods on credit. He had never set foot in her shop, but it was in her little stone church, hot and choked with people, that Elizabeth was christened. He paused in the entrance of her shop, adjusting his eyes to the yellow beams of light glowing from the lamps. It was a Tuesday night, and Miss Cora was there, leaned up at the counter, cradling her jaw. Inching closer, Lo could separate the cry of insects from the timbre of voices, and he could recognize the bursts of laughter, and he realized now that he had heard these very same jokes before, with the same interjections and snorts. He knew exactly what Mas Wali would say next, and that Raygun wouldn't respond to the jab until he had asked for another shot of rum. He knew that Spratt's bitterness over the woman that had run off would erupt soon. He swallowed bitterly. To them, nothing had happened. Their lives had not come to a complete standstill with the ground rotting away underfoot. The disruption had not eaten away at them and left them with wretched nights. The proof was here in the circular lines of stories that were the same he had heard every night for 30 years. For him, though, it had stopped. Now he had nothing. They had burnt it down, left him with nothing. But their lives had. Suddenly he was enraged. Suddenly he shook with the feelings. Suddenly his chest burned with the fever of his hate, and he turned on his heels, except that one of the men must have seen him, for someone grabbed his arm, and another a fist of shirt. Another fingered the waist of belt. "Is that you, Mr. Lo? Is the Chinaman that? My God, Mr. Lo!" He heard the surprise in their voices, the pause in their breathing. "Bring him come! Bring him come!" That was Miss Cora, in a loud and commanding tone of voice. "Come, come! Clear the counter! Bring him come!" Miss Cora again. "Lo, my God, man!" That was Jake, with no teeth at all in his mouth, so his words whistled. "Mr. Lo!" They held on to him. They pulled him to their chests. His nostrils brushed up against the stink of armpits, rubbed up against the sharp cloth of starched shirts, the soft sagging stomachs. "My God, Mr. Lo!" He felt their arms around his neck, wrapping his shoulders and chest, and he knew Omar had not struck yet. "Bring him!" Miss Cora again with a sharp voice. "And enough of this blasted hug-hug. Bring the man!" He heard the clink-clink of glasses on counter, heard the rip and break of new bottle cap, smelled the razor cut of rum. "Come, come, Miss Cora again." They must have lifted him off his feet, for he was suspended. There was no ground, and he was face to face with the cobwebs in the corner of the wall, face to face with the tops of glass case, oil drum, the shiny middle of heads. He was deafened by the thunderous roar of men, and he was face to face with Miss Cora at the counter, and she grinned, and he saw that her brown eyes behind the glasses were kind, and that her wig of straight and fine yellow hair, lightly dusted with flour, was crooked on her head, and so he could see the cottony curls of her own hair creeping out near her ears, and he saw her diamond-studded teeth in the lamplight, saw her shuddering chins, saw her arms swinging with brown flesh, smelled again the hoarse sweat of the men that had burnt down his shop, the rum smell, the carbolic soap smell of the men, the smell of cane juice and of unwashed skin, the smell of blood on the men who were arsonists. "Drink up now," Miss Cora again, with a mouth full of grinning gaudy teeth, and suddenly the shop was crowded with toasting men, men with firm brown arms holding up in the air glasses of rum, men who had burnt down his shop, men who still owed him 30-40 pounds, though once in a while a wife came up to the house on a Sunday evening to drop off a few shillings, men with mirth, men with merriment, men who beat their wives and fucked their daughters, men who loved him and other men. They dropped him to his feet. Lo put the glass to his lips, and the fire blooded his face and smarted his eyes and pounded so hard in his belly he felt his knees go wobbly, and Miss Cora burst out into a loud laughter that chopped up the night. "Drink up, man, Mr. Lo, drink up." And she polished off two more glasses and was pouring a fourth round again for herself and the others, and Lo said to them in a voice moist with confusion, for maybe it wasn't them after all, maybe it wasn't them, "Drink up, all of you, drink up, thank you." And he saw the shuddering brown sea of faces, the gaping holes of mouths, and he was deafened again by the muffled roar of men who had burnt down his shop, and there was no ground again, just the rotting and dusty tops of abandoned oil drums, just the zigzag crack of unpainted walls, just the forgotten objects of art and crumpled pieces of old letters and yellowing IOUs sheathed in dust. Each night now he spent at Miss Cora's shop was a celebration. Each night now someone brought him a hand of ripe Gros Michel banana, a head of St. Vincent yam, a foot of tobacco from Miss Sylvie, a string of perch, a cake of handmade soap. Each night now there was the rip and twist of new bottles of rum. Each night now they recalled again and again events that had occurred when Lo's shop was still standing, and they shook again with laughter. And every night now they drank and swore and cursed and threatened each other with murder and boasted and made bets. Each night now the shop piazza bristled with the political and social news of the country. They complained of the laws that had been passed to deter people from working away from the estates, taxes that had been instituted to prevent them from starting their own businesses. They talked of the closing of estates. They talked of the spread of cholera and how many they had already lost to the epidemic. They talked of word they had received from family members who had gone to other islands to seek work. And at first, Lo listened. And then he began to wonder again at the extent of their hypocrisy and hate. For who else would have burnt it down if it wasn't them? But now here they were, celebrating, talking story as if nothing had happened. Here they were, as if it was essential that there be no barriers between him and them, no shop counters. For here they were, openly discussing their plans in front of him, as if without the shop he had become one of them. And when he could stand it no longer, in a loud, sharp voice, he asked them, "So why the hell you burn it down? Why the hell?" The conversations hissed to a stop. The piazza grew silent. The men pulled a screen over their eyes and looked out into the darkness. "Jesus Christ, every night gift, every night present, but the shop, the shop!" His voice cracked. He started to weep. It sounded awful in his ears. It sounded unmanly. "But Mr. Lo, it wasn't we." That was Jake, holding Lo's leg with an iron hand and whistling through his gums into Lo's neck. "Time will point out the culprit, Mr. Lo, but it wasn't we, sir, it wasn't we." Someone handed Lo a glass of rum, and he boxed it away, and the glass exploded on the concrete not too far from his feet. "So now you're hiding him," Lo cried out, desperately wanting to believe them. "Is that, now you're taken up for him, taken up for each other?" He remembered the night they celebrated his return, and the tears rushed him again. "Mr. Lo, man," that was Jake, whistling in his neck. "Mr. Lo, calm down now, sir, calm down. It's not we, it wasn't we, sir." And he offered Lo his handkerchief and Lo blew fiercely into it and returned it. "Mr. Lo-man, is all right," Jake again with the iron hand on his kneecap, and Lo calmed with just the pressure of the hand on his knee and the whistling in his neck, and thought maybe it wasn't them at all. Maybe it wasn't them. Maybe it was more organized than that. Maybe it was the Native Defense people. Maybe it was just criminal elements stalking the countryside, for it wasn't usual. And he loved them again, these men who were his friends and had kept him company over the years, though he wasn't completely sure that they hadn't burned down the shop, wasn't completely sure they would still love him like this when Omar stripped him naked for all to look at in order to get the land. And there was a needling in his stomach that wouldn't go away, some old wound, some old sore, a needling. Thank you. Thank you.